Chapter 33. The Last Chapter. The telephone rang. He lifted the receiver drowsily.
"Ravitch," someone said.
"Yes?" It was Joan.
"Come," she said. She spoke slowly and softly. "Right away, Ravitch."
"No."
"You must."
"No. Leave me in peace. I am not alone. I'm not coming."
"Help me."
"I cannot help you."
"Something has happened."
Her voice sounded broken.
"You must. Right away."
"Joan," Ravitch said impatiently, "there is no more time for such play-acting. You've done this to me before, and I was taken in. Now I know about it. Leave me alone. Try it with someone else." He hung up the receiver without waiting for an answer and tried to go to sleep again. He did not succeed. The telephone rang once more. He did not lift the receiver. It rang and rang through the grey, desolate night. He took a pillow and put it over the instrument. It continued its muffled ringing and then stopped. Ravitch waited. It remained silent. He got up and reached for a cigarette. It did not taste good. He put it out. The remainder of the Calvados stood on the table. He took a swallow and put it away. Coffee, he thought. Hot coffee, butter and fresh croissant. He knew a bistro that stayed open all night. He looked at his watch. He had slept for 2 hours, but he wasn't tired any more. There was no point now in falling into a second deep sleep and waking up groggy. He went into the bathroom and turned on the shower. A noise. The telephone again? He turned off the tap. A sound of knocking. Someone was knocking at his door. Ravitch put on his bathrobe. The knocking became louder. It could not be Joan. She would have come in. The door was not locked. He waited a moment before going. If it were the police already, he opened the door. Outside stood a man whom he did not know, but who reminded him of somebody. He was wearing a tuxedo.
"Dr. Ravitch?"
Ravitch did not reply. He looked at the man. "What do you want?" he asked.
"Are you Dr. Ravitch?"
"You'd better tell me what you want."
"If you are Dr. Ravitch, you've got to come immediately to Joan Madou."
"Really?" "She has had an accident."
"What kind of accident?"
Ravitch smiled incredulously.
"With a gun,"
the man said.
"It went off."
"Was she hit?" Ravitch asked, still smiling. Probably a fake attempted suicide, he thought, to frighten this poor devil.
"My God, she's dying," the man whispered. "You must come. She's dying. I shot her."
"What?"
"Yes, I..."
Ravitch had already thrown off the bathrobe and reached for his things. "Have you a taxi downstairs?"
"I have my car."
"Damn it!" Ravitch flung his bathrobe over his shoulders again, took his bag and reached for his shoes and his shirt and his suit. "I can put these on in the car. Come, quickly." The car shot through the milky night. The city was completely blacked out. There were no streets any longer, only a floating, misty space out of which blue air raid lights emerged forlornly and too late, as if the car were driving on the bottom of the sea. Ravitch put on his shoes and his other things. He squeezed the bathrobe in which he had run down into the corner by the seat. He had no socks and no tie. He stared restlessly into the night. There was no point in asking anything of the man who was driving. He drove with full concentration, very fast, and paying complete attention to the direction in which he was going. He had no time to say anything. He could only swing the car around, make way for others, avoid accidents, and take care not to lose his way in the unaccustomed darkness. 15 minutes lost, Ravitch thought. At least 15 minutes.
"Drive faster," he said. "I can't, without headlights, dimmed, air raid precautions."
"Damn it, then drive with headlights." The man turned on the big lights. A few policemen shouted at the intersections. A dazzled Renault almost collided with them.
"Go on, keep going, faster."
The car stopped with a jerk in front of the house. The elevator was at the ground floor. Its door was open. Somewhere someone was ringing for it furiously. Probably the man had not shut the door when he had rushed out. Good, Ravitch thought, a few minutes saved. The elevator crept upward. It stopped at the fourth floor. Someone looked through its window and opened the door.
"What do you mean by keeping the elevator downstairs for such a long time?"
It was the man who had been pressing the button. Ravitch pushed him back and closed the door.
"Right away. We must go up first."
The man outside cursed. The elevator continued to crawl. The man on the fourth floor pressed the button furiously. The elevator stopped. Ravitch flung the door open before the man downstairs could start any nonsense and get the elevator down again with them in it. Joan was lying on her bed. She was dressed, an evening gown, high at the neck, silver with stains of blood. blood on the floor where she had fallen. Then the idiot had laid her on the bed. "Be calm," he said. "Be calm. Everything will be all right. It isn't very bad." He cut the shoulder straps of the evening gown and carefully pulled it down. Her breast was uninjured. It was her throat. The larynx could not have been hurt, otherwise she would not have been able to telephone. The artery was uninjured. "Are you in pain?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Very much?"
"Yes."
"That will be over soon." The injection was ready. He saw Joan's eyes. "Nothing. Only for the pain. It will stop at once." He applied the needle and drew it out. "All done." He turned to the man. "Call up Passy 2741. Order an ambulance with 2 stretcher bearers. Right away."
"What is it?"
Joan asked with an effort. "Passy 2741, Ravitch said. "At once. Go ahead. Start telephoning."
"What is it, Ravitch?"
"Nothing dangerous, but we can't examine it here. You've got to go to a hospital." She looked at him. Her face was smeared. The mascara had run from her eyelashes, and her lipstick was rubbed up on one side. One side of her face looked like that of a cheap circus clown, the other, with the black smear under her eye, like that of a tired, worn-out whore. Over it her hair shone.
"I don't want to be operated on," she whispered.
"We'll see. Maybe we won't have to."
"Is it—"
She stopped. "No," Ravitch said. "Not serious. Only we have all the instruments there."
"Instruments?"
"For the examination. Now I'll—" "It won't hurt." The injection had taken effect. Her eyes lost their anxious fixity while Ravitch cautiously examined her. The man returned. "The ambulance is on its way. Call up Otoi 1357. It's a hospital. I'll talk to them." The man disappeared obediently.
"You will help me?"
Joan whispered. "Of course."
"I don't want to have pain."
"You won't."
I can't endure—"
She became drowsy. Her voice died down.
"I can't—"
Ravitch looked at the wound where the bullet had entered. None of the large vessels was injured. He saw no wound where the bullet had left. He did not say anything. He applied a compress bandage. He did not say what he feared. "Who put you on the bed?" he asked. "Did you—"
"He—"
"Were you—" "Could you walk?" Alarmed, her eyes returned from veiled lakes.
"What? Is it—" "I— no. I could not move my foot. My leg—" "What is it, Ravitch?"
"Nothing. I thought so. You'll be all right again." The man appeared.
"The hospital—"
Ravitch quickly went to the telephone. "Who is it? Eugenie?"
"A room."
"Yes. And call up Weber." He looked toward the bedroom, softly. "Have everything ready. We must go to work right away. I've ordered an ambulance."
"An accident?"
"Yes. Yes. Right. Yes. In 10 minutes. He hung up. He stayed where he was for a while. The table. A bottle of creme de menthe. Disgusting stuff. Glasses, perfumed cigarettes. Abominable. All this was like a bad movie. A gun on the rug. Blood here, too. Everything unreal. What makes me feel that? He thought. It is true. And now he also knew who the other man was that had called for him. The suit with those padded shoulders. That smoothly brushed pomaded hair, the slight smell of toilet water that had irritated him in the car, those rings on his fingers. It was the actor, all right, about whose threats he had laughed so much. Well aimed, he thought. Not aimed at all, he thought. Such a shot could not have been aimed. One could hit with such precision only when one had no such idea and did not intend to hit at all. He went back. The man was kneeling by the bed. Of course, kneeling, it could not be otherwise, talking, wailing, talking, syllables rolling from his tongue. "Get up," Ravitch said. The man rose obediently. Absent-mindedly he brushed the dust from the knees of his trousers. Ravitch looked at his face. Tears. That, too. "I did not intend to, sir. I swear I didn't mean to hit her. I did not intend to. An accident, a blind, unhappy accident." Ravitch's stomach contracted. Blind accident. Soon he'll talk in blank verse. "I know that. Now go down and wait for the ambulance." The man wanted to say something. "Go," Ravitch said. "Keep that damn elevator ready. God knows how we'll get down with the stretcher."
"'You'll help me, Ravitch?'
Joan said drowsily. "'Yes,' he said, without hope.
"'You are here. I am always at peace when you are with me.'
The smeared face smiled. The clown grinned. The whore smiled laboriously.
"'Baby, I didn't—' the man said at the door. "'Get out,' Ravitch said. "'Damn it, go, will you?'
Joan lay still for a while. Then she opened her eyes.
"'He is an idiot,' she said with surprising clarity. "'Naturally he didn't intend to, the poor lamb, only wanted to show off. "'A strange, almost impish expression was in her eyes. "'I, too, never believed it. "'I teased him into—'
"'You must not talk.'
"'Teased.
"'Her eyes narrowed to a slit.
"'Now that's the way I am, Ravitch. "'My life. "'He didn't want to hit—hit, and—'
The eyes closed completely. The smile died away. Ravitch kept listening in the direction of the door.
"'We can't get the stretcher into the elevator. It is too narrow, at best half upright.
"'Can you get it around the landings?'
The intern went out.
"'Maybe. We would have to raise it high. We'd better tie her down.'
They fastened her. Joan was half asleep. At times she groaned. The interns left the apartment.
"'Have you a key?' Ravitch asked the actor.
"'No. Why?'
"'To lock the apartment.'
"'No, but there is a key somewhere.
"'Look for it and lock the door.' The interns were busy on the first landing.
"'Take the revolver with you. You can throw it away outside.'
"'I'll give myself up to the police. Is she seriously hurt?'
"'Yes.' The man began to perspire. The sweat surged from his pores so suddenly it seemed there was nothing else under his skin. He went back into the apartment. Ravitch followed the interns carrying the stretcher. The hallway was equipped with electric lights that stayed on only 3 minutes and then went out. On each landing there was a button with which to turn them on again. The interns got halfway down on each floor with relative ease. The turns were difficult. They had to raise the stretcher high above their heads and over the railing to get around. Their huge shadows danced on the walls. "'Where have I seen this before? I've seen this somewhere before,' Ravitch thought, disconcerted. Then it occurred to him. With Rajinsky at the very beginning. The doors opened while the interns called directions and the stretcher tore pieces of plaster from the walls. Curious faces appeared at half-open doors. Pajamas, mussed hair, sleep-puffed faces, nightgowns, purple, poison-green with tropical flowers. The light went out again. The interns grumbled in the dark and stopped.
"'Lights!'
Ravitch searched for the button. He touched a woman's breast, smelled stale breath, something brushed his legs. The light flashed up again. A woman with yellow hair stared at him. Her face hung in rings of fat, cold cream shone on it, and with her hand she held a crepe de chine robe with a thousand coquettish ruches. She looked like a fat bulldog on a lace bed.
"'Dead?'
she asked, with glittering eyes.
"'No,'
Ravitch walked on. Something squeaked, spat. A cat jumped back.
"'Fifi!'
The woman bent down, her heavy knees spread wide.
"'My God, Fifi, did they step on you?'
Ravitch walked down the stairs. The stretcher wavered below him. He saw Joan's head, which moved with the movement of the stretcher. He could not see her eyes. The last landing. The light went out again. Ravitch ran up the first flight again to find the button. At that moment the elevator began to hum, and it glided brightly lit down through the quiet darkness, as if it were descending from heaven. The actor was standing in the open wire cage. He glided noiselessly, irresistibly down past the stretcher, like an apparition. He had found the elevator waiting upstairs, and had used it to catch up with them. It was sensible, but it produced a ghost-like and terrifyingly comic effect. Ravitch looked up. The trembling had left him. His hands no longer felt sweaty under the rubber gloves. He had changed them twice. There was no choice but to overcome it. Weber stood opposite him.
"'If you like, Ravitch, call Marteau. He could be here in 15 minutes. You can assist him, and he can do it.'
"'No, too late. I couldn't anyway. Looking on even less than this.'
Ravitch took a breath. He was calm now. He began to work. The skin, white. Skin like anyone's skin, he told himself. Joan's skin. Skin like any other. Blood. Joan's blood. Blood like any other's blood. Tampon. The torn muscle,
Tampon. Caution. Go on. A shred of silver brocade. Threads. Go on. The channel of the wound. Splinters. Go on. The channel leading to... leading to... Ravitch felt his head growing empty. Slowly he straightened up. Here. Look at that. The seventh vertebra... Weber bent over the incision. That looks bad.
Not bad. Hopeless. There's nothing to be done.
Ravitch looked at his hands. They moved under the rubber gloves. They were strong hands, good hands. They had operated 1,000 times and had sewn ripped bodies together again. They had often been successful and sometimes not, and a few times they had made the almost impossible possible, 1 chance in 100. But now, when everything depended on them, they were helpless. He could do nothing. No one could do anything. An operation was impossible. There he stood and stared at the red wound. He could have had Marteau called. Marteau would say the same thing.
"Is there nothing that can be done?" Weber asked.
"Nothing. It would only shorten her life, weaken her. You see where the bullet lies? I can't even remove it."
"The pulse is fluttering, rising 130,"
Eugenie said from behind the screen. The wound grew a shade grayer, as if a breath of darkness had blown over it. Ravitch had the caffeine needle ready in his hand.
"Goramine, quickly, stop the anesthetic."
He made a second injection.
"How is it now?"
"Unchanged."
The blood still had a leaden tinge. "Keep the adrenaline injection and the oxygen apparatus ready." The blood became darker. It was as if clouds floated outside and cast their shadows over it, as if someone was standing in front of a window drawing the curtains tight.
"Blood," Ravitch said desperately, "a blood transfusion. But I don't know her blood type."
The oxygen apparatus began to work.
"Nothing? What is it, nothing?"
"Pulse falling, 120, very weak."
Life came back.
"Now? Better?"
"The same."
He waited again.
"Now? Better?"
"Better. More regular."
The shadows disappeared. The edges of the wound lost their grey colour. The blood became blood again. Still blood. The oxygen was working.
"Her eyelids are fluttering,"
Eugenie said.
"It doesn't matter. She may wake up."
Ravitch applied the bandage.
"How is the pulse?"
"More regular."
"That was by a hair's breadth," Weber said.
Ravitch felt a pressure on his eyelids. It was sweat, thick drops. He straightened up. The oxygen apparatus buzzed.
"Keep it going."
He walked around the table and stood there for a while. He did not think of anything. He looked at the tank and at Joan's face. It quivered. It was not yet dead.
"Shock," he said to Weber. "Here is a sample of her blood. We must send it out. Where can we get blood?"
"At the American hospital."
"All right, we must try it. It won't help, only prolong it a little."
He watched the tank.
"Do you have to inform the police?"
"Yes," Weber said.
"I ought to. Then you'll have two officials here who will want to question you. Do you want that?"
"No."
"All right. We can think that over this afternoon."
"Enough, Eugenie," Ravitch said.
Joan's temples had regained a little colour. The grey-white had a tinge of pink. Her pulse was beating regularly, weak and clear.
"We can take her back. I'll stay here."
She moved. One hand moved. Her right hand moved. Her left did not move.
"Ravitch," she said.
"Yes?"
"Did you operate on me?"
"No, Joan. It was not necessary. We have only cleaned the wound."
"Will you stay here?"
"Yes."
She closed her eyes and fell asleep again. Ravitch went to the door.
"Bring me some coffee," he said to the day nurse.
"Coffee and rolls?"
"No, just coffee."
He went back and opened the window. The morning stood clear and resplendent above the roofs. Sparrows were playing in the eaves. Ravitch sat down by the window and smoked. He blew the smoke out of the window. The nurse returned with the coffee. He put it beside him and drank and smoked and looked out of the window. When he turned back from the bright morning, the room seemed dark. He got up and looked at Joan. She was still asleep. Her face had been cleaned, and it was very pale. Her lips were hardly visible. He took the tray with the coffee pot and the cup outside. He put it on a table in the corridor. There was a smell of floor polish and pus. The nurse carried a pail with old bandages past him. Somewhere a vacuum cleaner was droning. Joan became restless. Soon she would wake up again, wake up with pain. The pain would increase. She might live a few more hours or a few days. The pain would be so strong that no injection would any longer be of much help. Ravitch went for a needle and ampules. Joan opened her eyes when he returned. He looked at her. "Headache," she murmured. He waited. She tried to move her head. Her eyelids seemed heavy. She moved her eyeballs with effort. "It feels like lead." She became wider awake. "I can't stand that." "It will be better soon." He gave her an injection. "It didn't ache so much before." She moved her head. "Ravitch," she whispered, "I don't want to suffer. I promise that I won't suffer. My grandmother, I saw her, I don't want that. And it didn't help her at all. Promise."
"I promise, Joan. You won't have much pain. Almost none." She set her teeth.
"Will it help soon?"
"Yes, soon. In a few minutes."
"What is wrong with my arm?"
"Nothing. You can't move it. It will come back again."
"And my leg? My right leg?"
She tried to pull it up. It did not move. "It's the same, Joan. Don't do anything. It will come back." She moved her head.
"I just intended to begin to live differently," she whispered.
Ravitch did not reply. There was nothing he could say. Maybe it was true. Who did not always intend that? She tossed her head from side to side restlessly again. Her voice became monotonous and with effort.
"It was good you came. What would have happened without you?"
"Yes." "The same thing," he thought in despair. "The same thing would have happened. Any quack would have been good enough for that. Any quack. The one time when I most needed all that I know and have learned, it is in vain. Any penny doctor could have done the same thing. Nothing." By noon she knew. He had not told her anything, but suddenly she knew.
"I don't want to be a cripple, Ravitch. What's the matter with my legs? I can't move either of them any more."
"Nothing. You'll be able to walk, as always, as soon as you get up again."
"As soon as I get up again? Why are you lying? You don't have to lie."
"I'm not lying, Joan."
"You are. You have to. You mustn't let me lie here when I am nothing but pain. Promise me that."
"I promise."
"When it's going to be too much, you'll have to give me something. My grandmother lay in bed for 5 days and screamed. I don't want that, Ravitch."
"You won't have it. You'll not have much pain."
"When it's going to be too bad, you must give me something strong enough forever. You must do it, even if I don't want you to, or I'm unaware. What I say now goes. Afterward, promise me."
"I promise. It won't be necessary." The frightened look disappeared. All at once she lay there peacefully.
"It's all right for you to do it, Ravitch," she whispered. "Without you, I wouldn't be alive anyway."
"Nonsense. Of course you would."
"No. From then on, when we first met, I no longer knew where to. You gave me this year. It has been a gift of time."
Slowly she turned her head toward him.
"Why didn't I stay with you?"
"It was my fault, Joan."
"No. It was. I don't know."
Golden noon stood outside the window. The curtains were drawn, but light came through at the sides. Joan lay in a drugged half-sleep. There was already little left of her. These few hours had devoured her like wolves. Her body seemed to grow flat under the blanket. Its resistance ebbed. She floated between sleep and waking. Sometimes she was almost unconscious, sometimes quite clear. The pain became stronger.
She began to groan. Ravitch gave her an injection.
"My head," she murmured. "It's getting worse."
After a while she began to talk again.
"The light. Too much light. It burns."
Ravitch went to the window. He found the shade and pulled it down. Then he drew the curtains closer together. Now the room was almost dark. He walked back and sat down beside her bed. Joan moved her lips.
"It takes so long. It doesn't help any longer, Ravitch."
"In a few minutes." She lay still. Her hands lay dead on the blanket.
"I must tell you so much."
"Later, Joan."
"No, now. There is no more time. So much to explain."
"I think I know most of it, Joan."
"You know?"
"I think so." The waves. Ravitch could see the convulsive waves go through her. Both legs were paralyzed now, her arms too. Her breast still rose.
"You know that I always... only with you."
"Yes, Joan."
"The other was just restlessness."
"Yes, I know." She lay silent for a while. She breathed with effort.
"Strange," she said then very clearly. "Strange that one can die when one loves."
Ravitch bent over her. There was only darkness and her face.
"I was not good enough for you," she whispered.
"You were my life."
"I can. I want... my arms can never embrace you."
He saw how she struggled to lift her arm. "You are in my arms," he said, "and I in yours." She ceased breathing for a moment. Her eyes were entirely in the shade. She opened them. The pupils were very large. Ravitch did not know whether she saw him.
"Ti amo,"
she said. She spoke the language of her childhood. She was too tired for the other one. Ravitch took her lifeless hands. Something in him was torn apart. "You have made me live, Joan." He spoke to the face with the fixed eyes. "You have made me live. I was nothing but stone. You have made me live."
"Mi amito?"
It was the question of a child that wants to go to sleep. It was the final weariness beyond all others. "Joan," Ravitch said, "love is no word for it. It isn't enough. It is a small part only. It is a drop in the river, a leaf on a tree. It is so much more."
"Sono stata sempre con te."
Ravitch held her hands, which no longer felt his. "You were always with me," he said, and did not notice that all of a sudden he spoke German. "You were always with me, no matter whether I loved you, hated you, or seemed indifferent. That never changed anything. You were always with me, and always within me." Up to now they had always spoken to each other in a borrowed language. Now, for the first time, without knowing it, each one spoke his own, and the barrier of words fell, and they understood each other better than ever.
"Baciami."
He kissed her hot, dry lips. "You were always with me, Joan, always."
"Son stata perduta senza di te."
"I was more lost without you. You were all the brightness and the sweet and the bitter. You have shaken me, and you have given me yourself and myself." Ravitch watched her. Her limbs were dead. Everything was dead. Only her eyes were still alive, and her mouth and her breath. And he knew that the auxiliary muscles of respiration would gradually succumb to the paralysis now. She could hardly speak any longer. She was gasping already, her teeth ground together. Her face was convulsed. She still struggled to speak. Her throat was in spasm. Her lips trembled. The rattle, the deep, ghastly rattle. Finally a cry broke through.
"Ravitch!" she stammered. "Help! Help! Now!"
He had the needle in readiness. Quickly he picked it up and inserted it under her skin. Quickly, before the next spasm came. She should not suffocate slowly, torturously, again and again, interminably, with always less and less air. She should not suffer senselessly. There was nothing but pain ahead of her, perhaps for hours. Her eyelids fluttered. Then they became still. Her lips relaxed. The breathing ceased. He drew the curtains back and pulled the shade up. Then he returned to the bed. Joan's face had become fixed and alien. He closed the door and went into the office. Eugenie sat at a table with the charts. "The patient in number 12 is dead," Ravitch said. Eugenie nodded without looking up. "Is Dr. Weber in his room?"
"I think so."
Ravitch went down the corridor. Some of the doors stood open. He walked on to Weber's room. "Number 12 is dead, Weber. Now you can call the police." Weber did not look up.
"The police have other things to do now."
"What?" Weber pointed at an extra edition of the Matin. German troops had invaded Poland. "I have news from the ministry. War will be declared today."
Ravitch put down the paper. "This is it, Weber."
"Yes, this is the end. Poor France." Ravitch sat a while. There was nothing but emptiness.
"It is more than France, Weber," he said then.
Weber stared at him. "For me, it's France. That's enough."
Ravitch did not answer.
"What will you do?" he asked after a while.
"I don't know. I'll join my regiment. Things here," he made a gesture, "someone will take over."
"You'll stay here. In wartime, hospitals are needed. They will leave you here."
"I don't want to stay here."
Ravitch looked about. "This will be my last day here. I think everything is in order. The uterus case is recovering. The gallbladder case is all right. The cancer case is hopeless. A further operation would be useless. That's that."
"Why?"
Weber asked in a tired tone. "Why will it be your last day?"
"They'll round us up as soon as war is declared." Ravitch noticed that Weber was about to say something. "Let's not argue about it. They'll do it all right."
Weber sat down on his chair.
"I no longer know. Maybe they won't even fight. Just surrender the country. One no longer knows."
Ravitch got up.
"I'll be back in the evening, if I'm still here, at 8.
"Yes." Ravitch went out. He found the actor in the hall. He had forgotten him completely. The man jumped up.
"How is she?"
"She is dead." The man stared at him.
"Dead?"
He pressed his hand against his heart with a tragic movement and staggered. Damned comedian, Ravitch thought. Very likely he had played something of the kind so often that he fell back into a role when it really happened to him. But maybe he was honest, and the gestures of his profession simply clung absurdly about his real grief.
"Can I see her?"
"What for?"
"I've got to see her once more."
The man pressed both hands against his breast. In his hands he held a light brown Homburg with a silk edge.
"Don't you understand? I must—"
He had tears in his eyes. "Listen," Ravitch said impatiently, "you'd better disappear. The woman is dead and nothing will change that. Settle this affair with yourself and go to hell. No one cares whether you get sentenced to a year in prison or dramatically acquitted. Anyhow, in a few years you'll be using it to show off in front of other women to conquer them. Get out, you idiot."
He gave him a push toward the door. The man hesitated a moment. At the door he turned around.
"You unfeeling beast! Sal Bosch!"
The streets were full of people. They stood in clusters in front of the big running electric bulletins of the newspapers. Ravitch drove to the Jardin des Luxembourg. He wanted to be alone for a few hours before he was arrested. The garden was empty. It lay in the warm light of the late summer afternoon. The trees showed a first premonition of fall, not of the fall that withers, but of the fall that matures. The light was golden, and the blue was a last silk flag of summer. Ravitch sat there for a long time. He saw the light change and the shadows grow longer. He knew they were the last hours in which he would be free. The proprietress of the Internationale could no longer shield anyone once war was declared. He thought of Roland. Not Roland either. No one. If he made an attempt to continue his flight now, he would be suspected of being a spy. He sat there until evening. He was not sad. Faces drifted past him, faces and years, and then the last unmoving face. At 7 he departed. He was leaving the last remnant of peace, the darkening park, and he knew it. A few steps farther up the street, he saw the extra editions of the newspapers. War had been declared.
He ate in a bistro that had no radio. Then he walked back to the hospital. Weber met him.
"Will you perform a cesarean? Someone has just been brought in."
"Of course."
He went to change. On his way he met Eugenie. She was taken aback at seeing him.
"Didn't you expect me any more?" he asked.
"No," she replied, and passed him quickly.
The child squealed. It was being washed. Ravage looked at its red, screaming face and the tiny fingers. "We don't come into the world with a smile," he thought. He handed the child to the assistant nurse. It was a boy. "Who knows what sort of war he's in time for?" he said. He washed. Weber was washing at his side.
"If it should turn out that you are arrested, Ravage, will you let me know right away where you are?"
"Why do you want to get into difficulties? It is better now not to know people of my type."
"Why?
Because you are a German? You are a refugee." Ravage smiled sadly. "Don't you know that refugees are always as stones between stones? To their native country they are traitors, and abroad they are still citizens of their native country."
"Well, that makes no difference to me, but I want you to get out as quickly as possible. Will you give me as a reference?"
"If you want me to." Ravage knew that he would not do it.
"It is an abominable thought. What would you do there?"
"For a doctor there is something to do everywhere." Ravage dried his hands.
"Will you do me a favor? Take care of Joan's funeral? There won't be enough time for me to do it."
"Well, naturally. Is there anything else to look after? Property or anything like that?"
"We can leave that to the police. I don't know whether she has any relatives. It is of no importance."
He put on his coat.
"Adieu, Weber. It was a good time working with you."
"Adieu, Ravage. We still have to settle for the cesarean operation."
"Let's count that off against the funeral. It will cost you more anyway. I'd like to leave you money for it."
"Impossible, impossible, Ravage. Where do you want her to be buried?"
"I don't know. In any cemetery. I'll leave her name and address here."
Ravage wrote it down on a bill pad of the hospital. Weber put the slip under a crystal paperweight in which a silver sheep was cast.
"All right, Ravage. I think I'll be gone too in a few days. We would hardly have been able to perform many operations without your being here."
He walked outside with him.
"Adieu, Eugenie," Ravage said.
"Adieu, Herr Ravage."
She looked at him.
"Are you going to your hotel?"
"Yes. Why?"
"Oh, nothing. I only thought..."
It was dark. A truck was standing in front of the hotel.
"Ravage," Morozov said, coming out from a house entrance near the hotel.
"Boris?"
Ravage stopped. "The police are in the place."
"I thought so."
"I have Ivan Klug's carte d'identité here. You know, the dead Russian? Still valid for 18 months. Come with me to the Scheherazade. We'll change the photos. Then you can stay at another hotel as a Russian refugee."
Ravage shook his head.
"Too risky, Boris. One oughtn't to have forged papers in wartime. Better none at all."
"Well, then what will you do?"
"I'll go into the hotel."
"Have you thought it over carefully, Ravage?"
Morozov asked.
"Yes, carefully."
"Damn it. Who knows where they will put you?"
"At any rate, they won't deport me to Germany. That's over. They won't even deport me to Switzerland."
Ravage smiled.
"For the first time in 7 years, the police will want to keep us, Boris. It took a war to get that far."
"It's rumored they're going to set up a concentration camp at Longchamp."
Morozov pulled at his beard.
"For this you had to flee a German concentration camp to get into a French one now."
"Maybe they'll set us free again soon."
Morozov did not answer.
"Boris," Ravage said, "don't worry about me. Doctors are needed in time of war."
"What name will you give them when they arrest you?"
"My own. I have only made use of it once here, 5 years ago.
Ravage was silent for a while.
"Boris," he said then, "Joan is dead, shot by a man. She is lying in Weber's hospital. She must be buried. Weber has promised to take care of it, but I don't know whether he'll be called up before that. Will you look after it? Don't ask me any questions. Say yes and be done with it."
"Yes,"
Morozov said.
"All right.
Adieu, Boris."
Take any of my belongings you can use and move into my room. You always wanted my bathroom anyway. I'll go now. So long.
Merde, Morozov said.
All right. I'll meet you after the war at Fouquet's.
Which side, Champs-Élysées or Georges V?
Georges V. We are idiots. Heroic, snotty idiots. So long, Boris.
Merde, Morozov said. We don't even dare to say goodbye decently. Come here, idiot.
He kissed Ravitch on the right and left cheek. Ravitch felt his beard and the smell of pipe tobacco. It was not pleasant. He walked to the hotel. The refugees were standing in the catacombs. Like the first Christians, Ravitch thought. The first Europeans. A plainclothes man was sitting at a desk under the artificial palm, writing down the particulars about each person. Two policemen guarded the doors through which no one had any intention of fleeing. Passport? The man in plain clothes asked Ravitch. No. Other papers? No. Illegally here? Yes. Why? I fled from Germany. It was impossible to obtain papers. Your name?
Frisenberg.
First name?
Ludwig.
Jew?
No.
Profession?
Doctor.
The man was writing. Doctor? He said, and held a slip of paper toward him. Do you know a doctor who calls himself Ravitch?
No.
He is supposed to live here. We received a denunciation of him.
Ravitch looked at him.
Eugenie, he thought. She had asked him if he was going to return to his hotel, and she had been so surprised to see him still free.
I told you that no one of that name lives here, declared the proprietress, who was standing by the door leading to the kitchen.
Be quiet, the man said ill-humouredly. You'll be punished anyway because you did not report these people.
I'm proud of it. If humaneness is to be punished, then go ahead.
The man looked as if he wanted to answer, but he stopped himself with a gesture of dismissal. The proprietress stared at him challengingly. She had protection and was not afraid. Pack your things, the man said to Ravitch. Take your underwear with you and something to eat, enough for a day. Also a blanket, if you have one. A policeman came upstairs with him. The doors to most rooms stood open. Ravitch took his suitcase and blanket.
Nothing else?
The policeman asked.
Nothing else.
You are leaving the other things here?
I'm leaving the other things here.
This too?
The policeman pointed to the little wooden Madonna that Joan had sent him at the Internationale after they had first met.
That too.
They went downstairs. Clarisse, the Alsatian maid, handed Ravitch a package. Ravitch noticed that the others had similar packages.
Something to eat, declared the proprietress, so that you won't go hungry. I'm convinced there will be no preparations made where you're going.
She stared at the plainclothes man.
Don't talk so much, he said angrily. I didn't declare war.
Nor did these people.
Leave me alone.
He looked at the policeman.
Ready? Take them away.
The dark crowd began to move. Ravitch noticed the man with the woman who had seen the cockroaches. The man supported her with his free arm. Under the other he had a suitcase, and he held another in his hand. The boy also was dragging a suitcase. The man looked at Ravitch beseechingly. Ravitch nodded. I have instruments and medicine with me, he said. Don't be afraid. They climbed into the truck. The motor roared. The car moved off. The proprietress stood in the doorway and waved.
Where are we going?
Someone asked a policeman.
I don't know.
Ravitch stood beside Rosenfeld and the false Aaron Goldberg. Rosenfeld carried a roll under his arm. The Cezanne and Gauguin were in it. His face worked.
The Spanish visa, he said, expired before I...
He broke off. The bird of death has gone, he said then. Marcus Meyer yesterday to America. The truck shook. They all stood tightly pressed against one another. Hardly anyone spoke. They drove around a corner. Ravitch noticed the fatalist Seidenbaum. He stood pressed into a corner.
Here we are again, he said.
Ravitch searched for a cigarette. He found none, but he remembered he had packed enough in his bag.
Yes, he said. Human beings can stand a great deal. The car drove along the Avenue Wagram and turned into the Place de l'Étoile. There was no light anywhere. The square was nothing but darkness. It was so dark that one could not even see the Arc de Triomphe. This concludes the reading of Arch of Triumph by Eric Maria Remarque,